All right. Today is part three. So we've had two parts of the Two Trees Redux sermons. This will be part three, probably the final one. The title of this one, including the hyphenation, is The Two Trees Redux - Part Three, : The Antidote. So today we're going to talk about the antidote. And to recap what we're talking about here, because it's very important to understand, and it's worth repeating this every single time and to write these down. There's four scriptures that give us the clue to what the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is about and the way it works. The first one is 1 John 2:16. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but it's of the world. Then we have Genesis 3, verse 6, which says that the woman saw the tree. She saw that it was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, and desirable to make one wise. Those are the exact same three things mentioned there in Genesis as they are in 1 John 2:16. Right? Good for food, she lusted after, pleasant to the eyes, lust to the eyes, and desire to make one wise is, again, the pride of life, that she could see that now, hey, I could become like God, I can do it myself. And then Jude 11 gives us three examples of woe. They say woe. For those who have gone one the way of Cain, Cain is one of the ways, he killed his brother. It's anger, the lust of the flesh. He could not control his own anger, his own flesh. And so we find that lust of the flesh is more than just things like, you know, the sexual desires or things like that. It's just not controlling your impulses in any way. And so anger is an example given by Cain. Or run greedily in the air of Balaam, who was after money. He was trying to curse Israel and get a big bag of money. Or perish in the rebellion of Korah. And we remember Korah was trying to be in power. He thought he could be in power. Desire to make one wise and pride. He thought he was just as good. And God said, nope, that's not who I've chosen. Now here's who I've chosen. And then what we find, the four scriptures, Matthew 4, chapter 4, 1 through 11, is when you look at the temptations that Satan did to Christ, they were around those exact same three things. And so from the start of the Bible to the end of the Bible, we have this pattern of threes in the way of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the way that Satan captures people. It's not an intellectual argument that will take you out. It's one of these things that will take you out. This is one of these things that will pull at you, and this is how people get taken off. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, or the pride of life. And so it's important to know this pattern because Satan did it in the beginning to man. He tempted Christ with it, and he did it throughout the history of man, and it's cited in the New Testament. You see examples throughout. So it's very insightful for us to understand the how of how he works on us. The how, the way that he does it. So, you know, Eve had the knowledge in her head and said, God told me this. She could quote God's word. But what took her away was the pull of the tree. Those three things pulled on her. And that was the first part. We went over the foundations of this. Second sermon, the second part, we went over the concept of red herring. A red herring is when you portray something on the outside, but underneath is one of these three things. Think of it like that. This is especially prevalent in religions today. So with people who are into religion and religious, you know, institutions, for maybe it could be money. They've got a huge installed base. Or they're in it for power or whatever they think. It's one of the things of the three things of the tree underneath something packaged as something else. Hey, it looks like this, but it's really this over here. And so it's important for us to examine that in ourselves. And this is where, if you do examine this, if you do look at yourself and say, hey, am I really doing any of this for the wrong reason, for power or for money, or am I secretly have this underneath? We need to question that and never mix the two together. You'll never get the right results or godly results when you mix the two trees. You will never get godly results when you mix the two together. So it's important to understand that. This is also a thing when you do this to yourself, with yourself, and clean it and make sure you're clear and clean on the inside. Then you can decipher arguments. And what we find, the red herring is a commonly used technique in society. If you see any of the issues out there, they'll throw out something. Hey, you know, it's for the rights of, you know, dreamers. You know, they have an equal right as a human being, and this is a country of immigrants. And, you know, the issue is just, are you here legally or not? It has nothing to do with not supporting somebody. But, yeah, this country is made of immigrants, but just be here legally. So there's always something tacked on to make you be pulled over here, but look what's actually underneath it. And when you begin to spot this pattern, you can unpack arguments too that the world throws at you, things in the news that might be confusing, because red herrings only confuse everything. It's not clear. And if you understand the operating principles of the two trees, You can see an argument and ask, could one of those be underneath one of these things? Is this person, you know, and we looked at some examples in the Bible where they were coppersmiths that made idols, and Paul came and was talking about how that's not a real God. And they said, oh, yeah, we're going to lose our trade. In other words, they're just going to stop making all this filthy money that they're making. But the way they packaged it was this is our great goddess, Diana, and you're insulting her. And so what, if you look at it, and everybody in the whole city there ran in and was confused. Why were they confused? Because it's not clear, right? And this is how every argument is. You see it on Facebook. There's this issue gets thrown out. But, you know, there's always something underneath a lot of these things. And it helps us be able to cut through that and decipher these things in real life. And so it was the same there. Those people were losing their livelihood and money. So it was a matter of, you know, lust of the eyes, what they could make money-wise, but they packaged it up as Goddess Diana. So you can see this, and you'll see it throughout the Bible. So it's good to know these things and start to spot them. So far, we've been talking about that side of the world. That's part one and part two. Part three, we're going to talk about the other tree, the tree of life. So we've been talking about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But what about the other tree? And what I want to go through today, how the other tree is an actual antidote, and how it's an antidote of the way of life of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's the exact opposite. These two contrast with each other. And let's go through how it's an antidote. So let's start and see this tree. I won't go to Genesis because it's just mentioned, but it doesn't say much about it. All it says is when they chose that tree, they got driven out and it was cut off from them. But we find a time, let's go back to Revelation 22, verse 1. We find a time where this tree is seen again, open again, available again, just like in the Garden of Eden originally. Revelation 22, verse 1 talks about the future. It says, "And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and the Lamb. And in the middle of its street and on either side of the river was a tree of life." So, hey, it's made its appearance again, "which bore 12 fruits, in each tree yielding its fruit every month. And then the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations, and there should be no more curse, but the throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him." So we see this tree in more detail, like we're provided with a little bit bigger glimpse of what the tree of life looks like. And it's quite interesting what it says about the tree of life. The tree of life is described as bearing 12 fruits. Now, we'll couple this with another scripture. "And each tree yielding its fruit every month." So not only do we have fruits and multiple variety of fruits, but we have them blossoming every month. I don't know about you, if you've ever grown, you know, a fruit tree and stuff, they can have seasons and times, but this is not something that necessarily grows year-round, unless it's climate-controlled somehow. But these grow year-round. Every single month, they produce again, and they produce again. So what we have is an abundance. We have lots of fruit. And not only do we have lots of fruit, we have 12 different types of fruit. So we have a variety of fruit. So the tree of life sounds a lot more interesting to me. But it's got a lot of fruit, and it's got 12 different fruit, and they blossom every month, year-round. And then go on with the other parts of it. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So not only that, the leaves provide healing. And healing in a number of different ways. Obviously, you know, this would mean physical, but it's also emotional and spiritual. You know, because the things that people need to fix are the things on the inside. This is why we have so many things happening today. Because the tree of the knowledge of good and evil has messed people up so much, they're way down that path. But this tree is for healing, and all that stuff that has been there needs to be worked out, spiritually healed, forgiven of sins, and then the process by which they come out of all of that is part of this as well. And it says there'll be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. Now turn back to Ezekiel 47:12. This is another location where the same trees are mentioned. Ezekiel 47, verse 12. And we'll put these two together because it's talking of the exact same thing. Again, you know, we had the pure river of water of life. Now we have, in Ezekiel 47, verse 12, the same thing, along the bank of the river. And on this side and that, so on both sides, will grow all kinds of trees used for food. Their leaves will not wither and their fruit will not fail. They will bear fruit every month because the water flows from the sanctuary. The fruit will be for food and their leaves for medicine. Talking of the exact same trees, and it describes it a little bit differently. If you put these together, you know, is it one tree with 12 fruits, or is it 12 different types of trees? Not entirely clear. It sounds like that, you know, Ezekiel is saying it's a bunch of different trees, a bunch of different fruits. And then the way Revelation does is it packages it up and kind of calls it as the tree of life. We don't know exactly, but we do know there's 12 different fruits, and we do know that they're on the tree, and we know that both of them say that they bear fruit every month. So it's quite interesting tree, this one. This is not your normal type of a tree. This is a tree of abundance. This is a tree of variety, and this is a tree of healing. If you think of those three things, that's in stark contrast to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And it's appropriately called the tree of life. You know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil isn't the tree of good and evil. That's not what its name is. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which the idea is when it says that you can become like God means that you have taken it on yourself to decide what good and evil is. You are like God. God, that's the job of God, who is the one who's the lawgiver that says here's good and here's evil, not for us to take that on ourselves. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil says you can be like God. In the sense that you don't have to listen to him, you can decide what you think is right and wrong. Does that not describe our society today? The eat of that tree, the knowledge of good. Hey, I can pick what I think is good and what is evil. That's the place of God. God is the one who does that. Tree of life is the opposite of all of that, not you doing it yourself. But this is a tree that if you look at it too, these trees are fueled and fed by a river. What's the river called? It's the river of life as well. If you read about that river of life, it's full of fish and life and vibrancy, and it just expands out. That comes from the throne of God. So you can see things here that are both symbolic, right? You know, God's spirit and coming from God and the growth and all of the healing and those type of things. But one day it'll physically also be around as well. You know, to have this type of a tree. So it's both of those things. You'll have a physical, but you'll have the spiritual of what this pictures as well, because what we're talking about here is the choice of choosing a way of life. Eve didn't just eat an apple and all of a sudden, boosh, like a magic potion. Whoa, there's a choice that was made, but this is a pattern of long time of what she chose to do and live with. I'm sorry, not just Eve, but Adam and Eve chose to live, and they reap the results of that life. The tree of life is one of life. There's growth, right? If you think about it, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is about being your own God. It's about lust. It's about seduction and destruction. The tree of life is about God. It's about constant abundance. It's about a variety. It's about healing. These things wouldn't be further from each other when you think about it. It would be polar opposite sides of each other. And so this tree is the one, boy, that sounds like, man, it's interesting they didn't choose this tree to start with. Can't blame them. We would have done the same. We're all human beings, and we wouldn't have done it better if you and I were there. God knew this. God knew that man would choose the wrong way and knew that Satan would come and tempt and pull them away. And so it's very important for us to dissect these two trees and understand how they work, because this tree is one of abundance and variety. Variety is good. God is a God of variety, and I appreciate that. What about you? But if all you had to eat were two Big Macs and some fries every day, you'd probably not only be fat, but you would be sick of the food. But God's a God of variety. Whenever you cook something, you know, we have so many things to cook with, so many herbs and so many different types of meat and so many vegetables and all types of grains. And when you put them together and you put bitters together and you put savory, you put all types of things together, you can pull out flavors that you just, wow, that's what an invention that is. And that's what God is like. When God talks about food, it's not just, hey, you have a Big Mac each day and I give you enough. It's not only do you have an abundance, I'm giving you a variety. There's a lot of different things here for you. And this is the way our God works. And I like that. And you see it around you. See it around you. You know, God could have made one tree. You know, I don't know about you. Have you ever done Legos and your railroad set when you're young, or create a video game? You know, you try and put trees in. I could probably get max two different types of trees if I'm creative. But, you know, how many did God make? Couldn't even tell you. But he made all types of different trees and all types of different leaves and all types of different bark. Didn't have to do that. But the variety of the way God works is one of abundance and one of variety. How many animals did he make? How many insects did he make? How many pairs of wings did he make that are this big and little lungs and little eyeballs? And like, just think about the magnitude and variety of how God works. And that's his way. And he offers this. So when the world's religions paint a picture of, hey, you're going to go to heaven and you're going to sit on a cloud and you're going to play a harp and gaze up into the sky, that is the most boring future you could ever think about. God is going to give us one that's amazing variety. And that's his point, an amazing abundance, an amazing, like, it's just going to be amazing. And you see this in the tree that he creates. It's the way of his life, his symbol of his life. And we can take this analogy and think about it further, and it might be worth thinking about it a little bit more, but I like the idea of bearing fruit throughout the year. And what he says about this tree, it's always growing. It's always producing. And it's a variety. Now, think about that about your life during the year. Have you had times where, you know, you're pressed in this way, and then you're pressed in that way, or you've overcome this, or, and it's not for any one of us the same problem. It's not for any of us the same time. Even in your own life, you may have something different going on at all times, but the experience and the growth and the fruit and the type of things that produce is a lot of different things. And that's how God works in our lives. It would be very boring if it was just one thing that you dealt with and one thing you did. But think about that ebb throughout the year. Man, I was never pressed so hard in this way. I'm glad I have a break from that. Now I'm producing in this way. And then, oh, wow, this was hard at this point, and it made me learn this. And when you think about the different types of fruit you're producing, that happens throughout the year for us. And God's way is never one where you stagnate. We're never just sitting there. You and I aren't called to sit here and just hang on to the last second. Oh, you and I are called to produce growth. This tree is a tree of life and living, producing things constantly. That's how this tree is made. Every single month, 12 different fruits, right? It's one of life, and it's watered by the river of life, the tree of life and the river of life. And then we have the healing like we talked about before, you know, spiritual healing, emotional healing, the complete picture. People so desperately need that these days. So how does, you know, each of these two trees in ways of life will deal with the same problem differently? If you want the fruits of the tree of life, you have to partake of that. Problem comes in when you start to mix them together, you don't produce the right fruit. You cannot mix them. You can't have a stream of bitter and sweet water. You can't have a tree that's an olive tree bear oranges. You can't have something that's mixed together. And the Bible talks about this. So this tree is one of abundance. This tree is one of life. Now, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil has those three guiding principles, the way Satan works: the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. How many guiding principles does the tree of life have? So the one tree has three. What are the guiding principles of the tree of life? How many do you think there are? I see a three. Do I see any other fingers? Okay, yes, that's part of the answer. I saw some tens, and that's a yes. Okay, let me start by saying it actually has two guiding principles. Tree of the knowledge of good and evil has three. Tree of life has two guiding principles. What are those? Matthew 22, verse 37 to 40. Christ says it. Christ says this specifically. Matthew 22, verse 37. Says Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two hang all the law and the prophets." Every single thing you see written in these books of the Bible hang on those two things. Start with those two things, and everything expands out from those two things. Every single thing comes from those two things, is motivated by one or the other of those two things. All the law and the prophets hang on those two principles. So everything written down is based on these two. So we have lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. We have love God. We have love your neighbors yourself, are the two guiding principles. Now God goes a step further because, you know, you could say that to people and they wouldn't quite know how to do it, right? You wouldn't quite, okay, it sounds great. I'm loving, you know, and how one person loves might be different than another person. And they're like, well, we're all loving. God's not all about that kind of mushy mess. He just says, no, let me help you. Let me take a next step and show you what I mean by that. I mean by that, here's how you love God and love yourself. And that's found in what was hands raised over here and back there. 10 commandments, right? The first part of the 10 commandments are about love towards God. The second six, our last part, is about love towards your neighbor. So when you think about these two things, everything springs out. So God's law is very interesting. It's very simple, simply motivated. Love God, love your neighbor. Think of it like that. Then let's give you a set of guiding principles that expand that out just a little bit. There's 10 commandments that come out from it. And then it just goes a little bit further out, even bigger. But it all funnels back down to two guiding principles. So this tree has two. It hangs on two. The other one hangs on three. Of course, that's the way of Satan, has to one-up God and think he's a little bit better, you know, if you think about it. But those are in stark contrast to each other. Now, the two principles, love God and love your neighbor, and it doesn't just say love your neighbor. It says love your neighbor as yourself. And we always talk about that as in like, oh, you know, self-love and affirmations. No, no, no. It just says that you have to take care of yourself in this life. You have to work. You got to provide for your family. You got to provide for those who may be sick. God gives laws of this. He gives the principle. No, no, no. Get out and work. Get out and work. Provide for things. But as you're taking care of yourself, and as you're doing to yourself, think about others and take care of them as well. As you're doing to yourself, as you're loving your family and everything else, also love everybody else. That's why it says that. It's not a, hey, we just have to self-affirmate each other in the mirror every morning. He's talking about you do take care of ourselves. You have to in this life. Take care of others as well. God's not a way of like monks where you give everything up. No, take care of yourself and your family. Go do the things that you need to. Work hard. The way of God is about working. It says 6 days work. Take a day off, but 6 days work. So the way of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is about wanting things that you didn't work for. Your neighbor has. You want to steal. You want to take it. You want to kill for it, right? You want to obsess over it. Lust after, oh, I have to. That is the opposite of the way of God. So what we're triangulating on here is there's an antidote that God gives us. There's an antidote that he gives us, and that antidote is the Ten Commandments. Now you say, okay, I know that. It's easy. I've got them memorized. But it's beyond that, because the Ten Commandments are very interesting wisdom from God. Remember what we said, everything starts from the two principles, and then the ten are just an expansion of those two principles. You know how many Mosaic laws there are? About 613 Mosaic laws. Is that a lot? Or is that a little? You know what? In a single year in America, 4,627 laws were added. One single year. That's not how many we have. That's how many laws in America were added in 1 year. God has 613. That is not a lot. When you think about an entire society and how you would act, it's not a lot of laws. Because God gives you the base principles. He expands it out to the 10. He expands it out to 613. And you say, what are you talking about? It's about an ox in a ditch? Well, it's not just about the ox. It's how the principle of how you show love and how you keep the Sabbath or not and how you show love to a neighbor. He gives you a principle based on an example. That example was of the day. If an ox is in a ditch, you do this or whatever it is. It's the principle he's trying to get through to us. Our laws in society are regulating every single possible thing and behavior potentially you could do or not do. One of these works and the other one doesn't. And we see this today. You can't legislate behavior. People still have it underneath. What God is saying is think about underneath. And here's how you apply that out. Starting with two principles, everything comes from those two. Here's some 10, here's some more. Practically applied. Do you get the idea now? He doesn't need to give us 4,272 million new ones a year. He just needs to give us that many, and you should get the idea. If you want to get the idea of how his law works, then you'll get the idea of how his law works. If you're eating of the other tree, you will reject this entirely and just pick it apart, right? But this is how it works. Just think about that. What a simply beautiful way of structuring a society and addressing the intent of things. You know what's really interesting, too, about the Ten Commandments? There's a simplicity in them, number one, and then there's a real depth to them at the same time. What do I mean by that? You ever wonder why they're written like, thou shalt not? It just sounds like a bunch of don't do this. Don't do this kind of a thing. Well, it's a set of laws. If you were to take the Ten Commandments and give them to any primitive society with no rules or laws or anything and had them just do those Ten Commandments on a carnal level, right? As in, okay, I won't have my own God. This is the one God. I will throw away these images. I will not kill my neighbor. I won't steal, commit adultery. It would transform any society in a primitive society into one that is really works well. When you think about it, if just on a carnal level you did the Ten Commandments, a primitive society would all of a sudden be in a good place and grow and do things just from those 10. That's why the Ten Commandments are at both the same time. It's deceptively simple. God has a brilliant design here. You could take this deceptively simple 10 list and give it to some carnal people and have them do that, and they would produce great fruits, and their society would be forever altered. But at the same time, there's a brilliancy because that's just a starting point. And that will produce the fruit, but there is a deeperness to them that Christ expounds on. There's an intent behind them and a purpose to why they were given and what is said. And this is something Christ says. Let's turn over to Matthew 5, verse 17 through 30. So the Ten Commandments are a fascinating construct. I always wonder why they said, don't do this, because I think it's, you know, you give them to a society like ancient Israel who was carnal in the day, and you just stop doing some things and live a certain way, you're going to have a good society. But Christ said, that's not where you stop. That's not just where you stop. The intent by which I meant by each of these is something deeper, and you have to ask what's behind. What is it? Matthew 5, verse 17 says, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For surely I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. So what's a jot and what's a tittle? A jot is one of the smallest letters, right? One of the smallest little letters is the way it's been interpreted. And then the tittle is like a freehand stroke, one of the smallest strokes. So one of the smallest letters and one of the smallest strokes, accent strokes. Think of it like that. It says not even one of the smallest letters or strokes will pass from the law, right? Till all is fulfilled. Not even that. This is how much that all of what was said back then still applies. Still applies. So Matthew 5, verse 19 says, whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of God. What were the scribes and Pharisees in their righteousness? You would think that they're amazing people back in the day because they were so zealous and they had the words and they were on fire and they were correcting everybody and, you know, they were a force of nature. But they did not actually keep them for the intent by which God delivered them. They further took them and did their own subdivisions of them and put their own lacquer on the top and said, here's how we think we keep those. They took the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I can decide what's right and wrong for this law that God gave me, and they spliced it up. What's the result? Again, when you can be the religious leader, you can sound religious, but you are not eating of the tree, but you mix them together, you will produce the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You will not produce the tree of life at all. They mixed them. Guess what they did? They killed the very Christ who gave the law. That's how far down that path it goes. So you cannot mix the two things, and you have to exceed the outward righteousness that they said, and it has to become from the heart. So Christ goes on and says, Here's how you have to exceed the righteousness of them. 21. You have heard it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. So, that's not the exact command. If you notice, it's part of it. But what it is it when it says that, you know, you've heard it said of those of old, is the way that they taught in those days, that they orally would pass down teachings. And so this is citing somebody orally passing down a teaching based on a commandment of what they said. You've heard it said like this. But really what I intended is not what they're teaching. Not just that. It says, I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. So bring your gift to the altar. And there, remember that your brother has something against you. Leave your gift there. Go away. Go be reconciled. Then come offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge hands you over to the officer, and you'll be thrown in jail. And I say to you, by no means get out of there till you pay the last penny. And so what Christ is addressing is he's expanding on what he meant when he gave the law of you shall not murder. He's saying, yep, start there in its simplicity. Don't just stop killing people. But what I mean by that is you have to deal with what's behind wanting to kill somebody. You're not going to stop people killing people by just, you know, trying to just stop the physical act. He's saying you have to get down to the heart behind it. And you have to say, are you even angry? Are you even doing any of these things? Those are just the same, if carried out, as killing somebody. If you think about, you take it to its extreme. If you don't deal with that, you end up killing somebody. Right? We have in the news a bunch of shootings, which is horrific, what's going on right now. And you have to deal with what's behind in the heart for these things to completely change over time. Yes, you can regulate behavior for a period of time, but that won't stop all the stuff until we deal with the heart of things. Right? If you look at the number of years in man's history without war, it's probably less than 250 years in the entire thousands of years. There hasn't been warfare. It's the way of man's heart and the way he does things. So Christ is saying, look, you may have heard it said like this, just, you know, boom, 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 boom. They were very much like, here's the law, and you're in judgment, and, you know, this is all it is. And Christ said, nope, I want you to deal with your heart. This is what I intended when I said that. This is the intent. So, one command, thou shalt not kill, murder, is both simple to a society that you could just keep that and you have a great society. And it's so deep to understand that that also means the intent is deal with the heart by why you would want to kill. Why do you want to kill in the first place? Because you're angry. You're mad. You're further down the path of progression to killing somebody. You have to deal with that part of it. And you see how the law is both simple sounding and works with a simple society, and it is then so deep and so far reaching when you actually dig into it. Let's go on in verse 27. It's the same thing it said here. It says, you've heard it said to those of old, or it was said to those of old, you should not commit adultery, which is true. That is a commandment. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it's more profitable that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable that one of your members perish than your whole body be cast in hell. So again, it's saying, hey, this is a proclivity. Get rid of the proclivity. If it's something that's causing you sin, get rid of it. It's not saying literally cut your hand off, but get rid of the proclivity. If you can't, you know, stop looking. Don't give yourself a chance to look. So it's dealing with what's behind it. Their leaders stopped at just the commandment, and then they further divided it up. Why did they divide it up in little bitty chunks? Doesn't that sound righteous to you? Hey, it says, you know, you should tithe. What do they do? If you have, you know, herbs that you bought at the store, go get your little razor blade and just, you know, make sure you measure off a tenth of that. What is the red herring there? Why did they do that? Because they wanted to look super righteous. They wanted to be more righteous than the person next to you. And if you saw them, you go, wow, that's devout. Cannot believe that. But that was also Durong. It's I don't even know what word that is, but hey, just go with me there. All right. But you know, that's missing the intent. You know why? The red herring is it's religious looking and devoted looking, but it was about their pride and who they could be seen as. Correct? Can you see that again? They mix the two trees. You do not produce the fruits of God when you mix the two trees. If you have a minister who's into power, you will not produce the fruits of God. So it's very important for any of us to be completely absolved of any of ourselves. Otherwise, you never produce anything of God. And this is what Christ is saying. You have to deal with what's the intent, the heart, the things that are behind. So it's quite interesting. This is a very elegant solution here in the sense of it's so simple. Stop doing these things, basically. You do some things. And you will change a society. But I really also meant when I said that you deal with the reason behind each one of those things. And so this is where you and I come in with the Ten Commandments. Sometimes we dismiss it. Oh, yeah, I memorized those in Sabbath school. And that's the last time we thought about them, you know, in any deep way. But the Ten Commandments are actually the antidote. How are they the antidote? And I'll finish on this thought. It's going to take me a few more minutes looking at the clock. Not that many. But the Ten Commandments are grouped, and they address specifically the three things of the Tree of Life. Do you know that? They specifically address. Think about this. The lust of the flesh are addressed by which ones? They're directly, let's start with that, lust of the flesh. Basically take 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So lust of the flesh. I'm lusting after my neighbors. 10, you should not covet. Don't lust after it. You're lusting after your neighbor's reputation and you want to bear false witness. Number 9. Can destroy their reputation. You should not steal. You're lusting after something somebody has. You should not commit adultery. You're lusting after a woman. 6, you should not murder. You're lusting after your hate is overwhelmed you. Those 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 directly counter the lust of the flesh of the other tree over there. The Ten Commandments are specifically written to be the opposite. What about the lust of the eyes? Some of those overlap. It's really 7, 8, 9, and 10. Think about it. You shall not commit adultery. Lust of the eyes. You're looking. You should not steal. You're looking at what people have. Bear false witness, right? You're lust after somebody's reputation. You should not covet. That's deliberately looking with your eyes. So if you look at 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, those deal with the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes directly. The antidote to the other tree is to implement 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, in their literal and spirit sense, the spiritual intent of them. Literally stop doing those things and then deal with the heart behind it. And you see that? The antidote, these are mapped exactly, exact opposites and written and said exactly the opposite. The one that I find interesting, though, is the one that's dealt with the most is the pride of life. The pride of life is dealt with commandments 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Fully half of the commandments. You could argue that some of the other ones in there are also pride of life. But let me just tell you why that these in the spirit and the intent are the pride of life. Number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are the antidote to the pride of life. So we only quote these very simply. Yet you should have no other gods before me. Yep, I don't have any other gods. I'm not, you know, some other religion. You should not make any idols. Yep, I don't make any idols. You shouldn't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Yeah, I slipped once, you know, last year, but I'm good. Remember the Sabbath day? Yep, I'm here. Honor your father and mother? Yep, I called them last year. Right, we can check those off and dismiss them. But if you look at the intent of why does he say these things? The why does he say and what's the intent behind them is the thing that is the antidote to the other tree. The pride of life is dealt with the most because of what reason? This is the biggest one, I think, for humanity. And this is the way that Satan is. Pride was found in him. Violence was found in him, too. But he operates out of pride. And he said, I can be just like God, didn't he? Where does that whole thought come from? I can be like God. I'm going to go try and set my throne up and be just as equal. And he got cast down to the earth. He operates out of pride. And the way that he operates on us, the number one way, he operates on the others, but is out of pride. getting to your pride, getting to your ego, getting to you to be something, to want something, some, just no matter what it is. You know, you could believe the dumbest story in the world, the latest thing, but if it makes you feel like you're a little bit smarter than the next person, that's why you'll swallow it. He knows that. It's not the argument. It could be flat earth. It could be anything that's ridiculous. But yeah, he'll get people to believe it. Why? Because it's a special thing that they know that nobody else can get. How dumb can you be? You can't get it. You see how it works. The pride is underneath these things. It's not just the argument. It's the pride underneath. That's the red herring part. So he deals with pride the most. The antidote to pride is, you should have no other gods before me. That is, you should put God first. The intent of that is to place God first, to think about him first, to wake up, to put him in. If it comes between something, a job and this, that you put him first, that your God is God, not some other God that comes before him. You should not make any idols. Could be making anything more important. The idea of not making any idols is that we put God in a box. That we say he's just like a statue here, and you can put some frame around how big he is and where you stick him. You stick him over in a box. Making an idol would be doing the same thing, that you say, oh, you know, this is how I choose to have the view of God, versus looking in his scripture and looking at how big his universe is and having your mind go, I cannot get around the bigness of how God is, and he is way bigger and his ways are way higher than my ways. So making an idol is to limit and put him in a box of how we like to interact with God. Think of it like that. Yep, this is the parameters by which he'll be in my life. Nope, you should think I'm going to study and see what God really is and see what he wants me to see. And you should not take the name of your Lord God in vain. That's not just about swearing. That means you shall not have the name of the Lord God attributed to you as a person in a vain way. You cannot say I'm a child of God and then go do a whole bunch of stuff. This is saying, are you bearing his name too in a worthy way? Or are you living a way that's causing it to be seen as in vain? Wow, that person says they're of God, but yeah, when they're, at home, they're smoking and drinking and, you know, swearing up a storm and getting a fight with the neighbor, you wouldn't attribute anything of God to a person like that. So are you bearing the name? Don't take the name on you of the Lord God in vain. Live a life that's worthy of his name. So you set your ways aside for his ways. And remember the Sabbath day, a big one. You know, it's easy to work and try to make more money, and you could add another day and do it more productive. And God tells us, no, that I have declared this day holy. You have to set yourself aside. And not just, hey, I slept through the Sabbath day, I didn't work. It's, can I put my thoughts aside? Can I do and think the thoughts of God on the Sabbath day? You can start to see how all these things are the opposite of your own personal pride. What would your own pride say is, no, I can be just as powerful. I can put God in a box if I want, and you know, I can do what I want. I can always ask for forgiveness. You'll start to go down and mix the two trees. You will never produce the things of God. And then the last one of pride is honor your father and mother. Why is that in there? Because it's very important. You know, it's important for us to set aside ourselves to honor our parents. It's a commandment with promise. Sometimes it can maybe not be easy to honor your parents, right? Can be, but you need to set it aside. It takes a lot of your own pride to be set aside to always do that and make sure that you give time back to that. If you see, the first five actually are really the intent behind them is setting yourself aside. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is going to say you don't have to. You can be just like God. You can decide. You can put God in a box. You can do this. You don't have to keep the Sabbath day anymore. You know, et cetera, et cetera. So the Ten Commandments, when we talk about an antidote, are the antidote for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The first five deal with pride. The last six, seven, eight, nine, and 10 deal with the lust of the flesh and lust of the eyes. Directly counter to every single piece on this tree is the things in this tree. So why do I bring that up? Because it's an antidote, and it's something for us to think about in a little bit different terms. It's for us to go back to the Ten Commandments and to take them a step deeper and ask the question, why did God say this and what intent is behind this and how do I fix it with fixing my heart to do that fully, right? I didn't kill somebody. We can all check that off. God's saying, no. Did you deal with the ramp up to killing somebody, which is getting mad and angry and everything else? So if you want the abundance, 12 fruits all the time, throughout the year, leaves that are healing, then you have to fully go that way. Well, the problem is we mix them. We end up mixing them and we don't produce anything good. So this is for us to do. When I say the antidote, let's look at the Ten Commandments a little bit differently when we think about it. Do you want the benefits of this life, the tree of life? Then we can't mix them together. So I'll read one last scripture, just one. We'll finish here. Acts 3:11. Here's a very pure example of living life and not mixing the tree. So what would each tree do in the same example? Let's read the example. It says, Acts 3:11. It says, "Now as the lame man who was healed held on to Peter and John, all the people ran together to them in the porch, which is called Solomon, greatly amazed," right? And they were staring at them like they're amazing people. So they just performed a healing, and a whole group of people came running. Whoa! They're amazed, and they're, you know, basically falling down to worship these two. What would each tree do in this same circumstance? Each tree would act different here. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil would go, maybe humbly, "You know, you're right. I did have to get up and I had to pray. And, you know, it's I try to do the right thing. And, you know, God's blessing that." What was that about? It was about you. Again, your pride. You know, or somebody would go, "Yep, I'll heal you too. You know, I've been out of work and I really need some money to support it." You know, then you're about money. You know, if you think about it, you could slide into the tree in any sort of a way that sounds good. But what would the tree of life respond as? And that's how Peter responded. He says, "So when Peter saw it and responded to the people, he said, 'Men of Israel, why do you marvel at this or look so intently at us as by our own power or godliness we made this man walk?'" Like, don't look at us. This is not our power. He even said, "This is not me doing good. I didn't get up this morning and pray so good, and this is why this happened." He says, don't look at us. Don't look at the, you know, desire to make one wise or the pride of life. Like, "Oh, yeah, maybe I'm something." Don't. Please don't. He says, pointing to God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who glorified his servant Jesus. I mean, where is he pointing? "Whom you delivered up and denied in the presence of Pilate." He was, you know, determined to let him go. So we see a zero mixing here. A zero mixing of the two trees results in the works of God when you go tree of life. It won't when you mix it. I don't know if that's clear by now, but when you have even an underlying bit of it, it won't produce the tree of life. It has to be pure. So for us to become pure, for us to apply the tree of life, let's think about the purity of, is anything of those three things, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life, underlying what I'm doing? And not only that, if I look at the antidote, how can I live the intent of the Ten Commandments and think about that? Did I put God first? Am I bearing his name in vain? There's a bunch of things to think about the intent. And when you live that way, you will produce that way. That's how it works. We don't mix them. All right, that's my series of three. I'll figure out another series later, but thanks for joining in on this. So.